Let me just go through a couple of political historical elements. Just scanning over the Orlo chapter that I just think I need to address by way of background. Not just for this section, but for the next section as well, regarding the Weimar Republic. First of all, the circumstances under which the Republic was established were themselves very unstable. Now, I've told you a little bit about the fact that it's really triggered by this plan for a last offensive and what seemed to be, you know, essentially a suicidal effort on the part of the German military. And it did peter out on the Western Front after a period of a short period of success, but those sailors had balked up in Kiel and had revolted. And that's really triggers this groundswell that leads to the flight of Wilhelm II himself, and essentially the high command throwing its hands up. Well, who were left with the goods? Right? The Social Democrats, who still dominated the Reichstag. Right? So they're left with a situation where the high command has put them into an untenable position. And they have to formulate quickly a government. Now, the thing to remember is that as a result of the war, the tensions within the left had resulted in a split over the issue of voting for a war budget. Now, the left has always had its tensions between those who feel that it's time for a revolutionary avant-garde to press for revolution as soon as possible, right? And those who feel that a more gradual revisionistic strategy will be more effective in the long term. Okay, so there are many more splits than that, but that's the main one, and I think I talked a little bit about that in setting things up earlier. Right? So the left is split, and that split, it doesn't split exactly on those lines, because most socialists did side with the nation. Nationalism was larger than socialism. It was a mistake that the left continually makes, thinking that workers will align with other workers more than they will align with fellow nationals. That just didn't prove to be true and has never really proven to be true. So it's a chink in the theory. But certain elements of that more radical wing of the party, of the Socialist Party, did resist the war. Did not want the socialists to support the war budget, and spoke out against it, and spoke out against the war throughout its duration. Pacifists, but also, you know, staunchly anti-capitalist and against the Wilhelmine system as a whole. And the most famous of those were Karl Liebknecht and Rosa Luxemburg, and they just deserve mention. It would be remiss of me not to mention them here. Karl and Rosa Luxemburg. And they were very brave. That's all I can say. As soon as they would be released from some extended period in jail, they would go out and go to some rally and speak out against the war again, and they'd get thrown right back in. I mean, they had a tremendous amount of personal bravery and stood up against this all along. Now, as the war ended and these revolutionary conditions were present, this radical wing of the party saw an opportunity to press things further and jumped at it. The Russian Revolution had taken place already, and the Russians were, of course, had theorized that the Germans would follow. The Germans having the largest socialist party in Europe, the assumption was that it's just a matter of time before Germany has a socialist communist style Soviet system. Right? So Lenin was certainly expectant of this. But they were acting on their own, and they really believed that it was time to press. It was time to press for this further step. So, as the Socialist Party as a whole is working to establish a government, and actually on the same day that it announces the foundation of the Republic, they're not called communists yet, the independents, they declare a Soviet system on the same day, November 9. So you have these dual visions of what the new system was going to be. Liebknecht is the one who's pushing this. Rosa Luxemburg has her theoretical qualms, but she goes with Liebknecht on this, right, against her better judgment. And you have a split. Okay. Now this intensifies. Street fighting's taking place over this. Soldiers are coming in. They're trying to decide which way they're going to go. Are they going to support the Republic? Everybody is terrified as the army returns. What is going to happen? It's just going to be chaos. And the head of the moderate socialist government, Friedrich Ebert, right, he cuts a deal with the military, with Groener, and says, look, what we need this to be a smooth transition. Right? We need the soldiers to act in a disciplined way. So he cuts a deal with the military command, and eventually that is, to a certain extent, you might say that's the original sin of the Weimar Republic. Because what that does is send signals to the more radical elements that there's room for them. And these Freikorps groups develop, which are unofficial military groups, and they oppose the Republic as a whole. But they're not getting smashed right away. Right? There's room for them. And Ebert makes a deal. We need order first. And the police chief is named Noske. He gives a wink to these Freikorps members. Right? And they go out and ultimately arrest Liebknecht and Luxemburg. And unofficially. They're not police. They're not even official, any part of the government. But they have this free movement in the city. And they torture them, beat them to death, and throw them into a canal in Berlin. This causes a divide in the German left that will never be repaired. The German left is going to be split. The great leaders, Liebknecht and Luxemburg, are murdered as a result of what's seen as the co-optation by Friedrich Ebert and the socialists in the first months of the Republic. Right? So from that point on, there's a rift that's really going to be very difficult to be overcome. Even if it were it could have been done theoretically, it's just so symbolic that Luxemburg and Liebknecht. And by the way, Döblin goes on after this to write a 3-volume novel on the November Revolution, and one of those volumes is Karl and Rosa, which does an internal monologue of Karl and Rosa as they go through those weeks of the November Revolution and until their deaths. It's just beautifully done. Okay, now, just a word on the Weimar Constitution, which Orlo goes through, and just sort of scanning over the top of what he said. It's a very liberal constitution. It's not a Soviet constitution, but it has a lot of civil liberties, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, and representative government that was actually based on that 1848 revolution that never took hold. Women's rights to vote, and mostly a direct representational system, directly proportional. Okay, so like we're seeing here, we're having this issue of the Democratic primaries, we have proportional representation. Whatever percentage of the vote get, they get the percentage of the delegates, versus the Republican version where it's winner takes all. Right? Well, they had this representational version. And what that means is splinter groups, many, many splinter groups. And it's very complicated to follow Weimar politics, and I'm not going to hold you to it. But just a list here of those which are just the main ones that Orlo mentioned: the DNVP, the DVP, the DDP, the SDP, USPD, the KPD. You have all of these parties involved. And then a lot of smaller parties as well. And if you can just get 1%, then you get a delegate at the Reichstag. And this caused a lot of difficulty in putting together coalitions to govern. They're constantly having to put together complicated coalitions. So it's much freer, and it's very democratic. Right? But in the end, it causes trouble because these splinter groups can stall any kind of legislation that's taking place. So it comes to symbolize the difficulties or the weakness of representative government. And this is why Hitler can refer to democratic politics as nothing but a talk shop, because they can't get anything done. Largely because groups like his are interfering, but you know that's not his point. Okay, another element here is that in that those first months, the Ebert government invokes an article written into the Constitution for emergency purposes, right? Which allows the chancellor to rule without reference to the Reichstag, without reference to Parliament. Article 48. Okay, and this is, you know, at that time, you know, it probably you know seems innocuous, but it's going to be used three times. And what that does is provide a precedent for the dictatorial rule that Hitler will invoke once he comes to power. It had been written into the Weimar Constitution. What he did was legal, and there was legal precedent for it. Right? So it's just one of those things. What the Nazis talk about seizure of power, and we talk about the Nazis seizing power as if they came in with a junta and just took control illegally. They didn't. They worked within the Constitution that existed, so it was not illegal. They didn't do anything. They started with an illegal strategy, the Beer Hall Putsch of 1923, that blew up, and from that point on, Hitler says, I'm going to do this legally. I'm going to do this legally, and he doesn't seize power. But he's put into power by a group of conservatives who had invoked Article 48 during the Depression era. Right? So, but it's all done within the framework of this Constitution. Then Orlow talks about Versailles, and we've talked about a bit about that, the main issue being that of German war guilt, and that just is a thorn that is stuck in the side of the Weimar Republic all the way through. It's just, there is this consensus, for the most part, popular consensus, that Germany had been screwed and Germany deserved to be treated better and internationally, and that the dictates against German militarization and as well as German internal politics had to be removed. And that works against the Republic, because the Republic has to negotiate with France and negotiate with England and try to exist with reference to them. But anything that it does that marks conformity to the Versailles Treaty is just fuel for this criticism, especially from right-wing criticism. And then, of course, there's the whole economic catastrophe of inflation. And Orlow does a better job than I can of this, of printing too much money in order to pay for the initial costs after the war, but you know, in large part to pay those reparations. It's an oversimplification of it, but the reparation requirements were stringent and extreme. And in order to fulfill those, as well as get the economy going, they had to first print money and then borrow money from the United States. In these plans, culminating in the Dawes plan, in order to prop up the economy. Well, that economy is being propped up by the American economy, and in 1929, when the American economy collapses, right, that's what you get. But this is the era where you'd have, you know, all of the savings of middle class people, retirees, just disappear. Boom. Right? Just the cost of a loaf of bread takes up a lifetime savings. Bam. Right? And then it just gets worse after that. And unbelievable rates of unemployment, 30%, not being irregular at all. And that's why you have all of these images of the unemployed, of people who are just hopeless, and people like Franz Bieberkopf who wants to work, who would like to do something productive, but just has no opportunity to do it, and is forced into this criminal lifestyle. And then, in addition to the left-wing splinters, of course, you have the gradual development of more, better and better organized right-wing counter-revolutionary groups. They're present from the very beginning, and we'll talk more about this, but the streets of Munich and the streets of Berlin are just filled with I'll just say rogue political organizations with paramilitary groups clashing in the beer halls, clashing in the streets, clashing in the rally halls constantly from 1920 until 1933. And that's why they have these paramilitary wings. The Nazis were not unique in having the stormtroopers. The left wing had its stormtroopers, the Reichsbanner group. And every small group had a group of thugs that would protect its rallies and go and disrupt the other rallies. So this militarization of politics at the street level, brutalization, banging heads, really gang warfare, but not just gangsters for the way we understand it, but gangsters with a political ideology behind them. That's the way it was on the streets of German cities. Okay. So that's just scanning over Orlo for some of the major things that definitely relate to what we're talking about and what we will be talking about. Okay. So let's now finally turn to the book and just dive in for the most part. Now, I uploaded for you, and it's here somewhere before it shuts down, but... schematic summary of the main storyline of the book, which is pretty hard to follow. I understand that. So that you can follow that along. That's just the spine that holds this together. And I'll make some references to those touch points as I go. But my interest is just drawing out these packages of information that Devlin gives us about life on the ground, on the street, in Berlin, in the 20s. This novel takes place in, I believe, 1927, and this is a period of relative stability. Between 27 and 29 is referred to as the golden years, because the American loans were working temporarily. The economy was stabilized to a certain point, and you do have the return of some financial stability and progress. So that's why you have people who are able to go to amusement parks, people purchasing things, a pretty lively economy taking place during these few years. And that they're referred to as the golden years. But on either side of that, you have catastrophe. From 1920 until they stabilized things, 1925 or so, everything was very dark. And then, of course, you know in reading this that in 1929 things are going to tank again. So this is this period of relative prosperity. Okay. So starting at the very beginning with the epilogue before we have page numbers. This book reports the story of Franz Biebekopf, an erstwhile cement and transport worker in Berlin. He's just been discharged from prison, where he's been doing time because of former incidents, and is now back in Berlin, determined to lead a decent life. And of course, that runs through the whole story. He wants to be good. Right? He wants to be honest. He's been in jail. Right? He's also been in the war. Right? And he tells his girlfriend, Lena, and others that he's trying to do it clean. And that's essential to the whole story, because the story is of an individual who is doing the best it can to in order to live an upright life. And in some ways, I don't want to push it too much, but I think it would be a legitimate and an introductory course to think of him as something of a symbol for the whole Weimar Republic, trying to do things in an upstanding way, trying to operate with this very open, democratic constitution, right? But just battered by economic disruption, violence, and ultimately collapsing. Again, that's a little bit too simplistic, but I think, to a certain degree, Franz does symbolize the main thrust of Weimar Republican history in that regard. At first, he succeeds, but then though economically things go rather well with him, he gets involved in a regular combat with something that comes from the outside, with something unaccountable that looks like fate. So this this sense of darkness and sense of pessimism. Next page. This awful thing, which was his life, acquires a meaning. Franz Bieberkopf has been giving a radical cure. At last we see our man back on Alexanderplatz, greatly changed and battered, but nevertheless bent straight again. To listen to this and to meditate on it will be of benefit to many who, like Franz Bieberkopf, live in a human skin, and like this Franz Bieberkopf, ask more of life than a piece of bread and butter. So that's the introduction to the whole book, this whole cycle. You're going to go through this hell, and then there's going to be a fairly positive ending. And but the whole gist of it is the survival of this individual, the effort of this individual to survive on his own, right? To make it on his own. And that's fundamental, I think, to Döblin's perspective. He, just to set this out there, I don't think Döblin thinks he can do it alone. And that has something to do with Döblin's political perspective. I think that he's coming at this with a intellectual socialist orientation, which really believes that the Franz Bieberkopfs of the world should rally together, they should be functioning together. All these efforts of Franz to stand up to things for himself, to use his own muscle, to use his own brawn, to use his own strength to survive all of this. This is his mistake. And the message is that he should find solidarity with others. Ultimately, actually, Döblin, when he sees the failure of that on the left, is going to turn to Catholicism. His later books are going to have a much more Christian bent. But at this point, I think the message is Franz should learn to unite with his fellow workers and become conscious of that that class aspect of their suffering. So that's the overall scheme, I think, of the text. But let's now move into the story itself. The release of Franz, starting on page 4. He stood in front of the Tegel prison gate, which is just in the outskirts of Berlin, a small town outside of Berlin at that time, and was free now. And I'll just skip ahead. The terrible moment had come. Terrible, Franz. Why terrible? The 4 years were over. That means the 4 years of his incarceration. The black iron gates, which he had been watching with growing disgust for a year, and from inside, he's been looking at those gates. Disgust. Why disgust? Were shut behind him. They had let him out again. Inside, the others sat at their carpentry, varnishing, sorting, gluing, and had still 2 years, 5 years to go. But he was standing at the car stop. The punishment begins. So the punishment wasn't being in jail. Being in jail provided him with order and stability and relative protection. The punishment begins when he's thrown out of that gate into this new modern world. He shook himself and gulped. He stepped on his own foot. Then, with a run, took a seat in the car, right among people. Go ahead. At first, it was like being at the dentist when he has grabbed a root with a pair of forceps and pulls. Pain to be thrust into this modern world of train car, of people, of crowds, and so on. The pain grows. Your head threatens to burst. He turned his head back towards the red wall, but the car raced on with him along the tracks. Here's that sense of that speed that the opening of the film provided. And only his head was left in the direction of the prison. So he snapped, right? The car moves so quickly, and he's still looking at the prison. The car took a bend. Trees and houses intervened. Busy streets emerged. Seestraße. People got on and off. Something inside him screamed in terror. Look out, look out. It's going to start now. The tip of his nose turned to ice. Something was whirring over his cheek. 12 Uhr Mittagszeitung. BZ. Berliner Illustrierte. Die Funkstunde. So newspaper headlines. He's obviously looking at the newspapers. Anyone else got on? The coppers have blue uniforms now. So he notices a cop. He got off the car without being noticed when he's back among people again. What happened? Nothing. Chest out, you starved sucker. You pull yourself together or I'll give you a crack in the jaw. Crowds. What a swarm of people. How they hustle and bustle. My brain needs an oiling. It's probably dried up. What's all this? Shoe stores, hat stores, incandescent lamps, saloons. People got to have shoes around so much. Didn't have a cobbler shop out there. Let's bear that in mind. hundreds of polished window panes. Let them blaze away. Are they going to make you afraid or something? Why, you can smash them up, can't you? What's the matter with them? They're polished clean, that's all. Right. So this whole stream of consciousness has all of these things impact his mind, just like the collage style of the film was trying to communicate and capture. Right away, you're into that whole flow of packets of information slamming into your brain, not in any particular order, because it doesn't come in any particular order, right? It just comes at you in this way. Page 6. There's lots of that, so that was just an introduction to it. Terror struck him as he walked down Rosenthaler Straße and saw a man and a woman sitting in a little beer shop right at the window. They poured beer down their gullets out of mug. Yes, what about it? They were drinking. They had forks and stuck pieces of meat into their mouths, and they pulled the forks out again and were not bleeding. Oh, how cramped his body felt. I can't get rid of it. Where shall I go? The answer came, punishment. Right. So everything is strange and absurd to him. And I don't know if he was reading Kafka, but you know, when Kafka just describes something, exactly how it looks, doesn't really explain what's going on, but you know, somebody's standing there and their head's tilted to the side and you know, they're scratching their foot or whatever it is. You know, he captured the absurdity of that experience. Not that it's anything unique, but when you just describe it and look at it, I mean, I could say something like, you know, they had their pencils stuck in their nose, in their lips, you know, and their pencils weren't going through the backs of their heads or something like that, right? The weirdness of everyday life. And he has an eye for that because he's just come out of prison. So there's that disorientation and that modernist style that captures all of that. Right? 7, the cars roared and jangle on. Right, so all the noise and disorientation, sound and movement of the city. House fronts were rolling along one after another without stopping, what it's like to move through the city in that futurist way. And there were roofs on the houses. They soared atop the houses. His eyes wandered straight upward. If only the roofs don't slide off. But the houses stood upright. Right? So he worries that this whole thing's going to collapse on him, that sense of threat. Okay. So, you're really into this right from the very beginning. Let's move to... Let's see. I'm going to skip this section because of, you know, what I've done to myself time-wise about the Jewish story, but just by talking over the top of it. On, I think, 3 occasions that I can think of right now, he goes to visit these Jews. And that's what he refers to, the Jews. And they tell him stories. And I've thought about this. What was Dublin doing with that? Why does he go to them? It's at times of great duress, immediately after he gets out. And then they tell him these stories. And it's sort of these stable points where he sits and he listens, and there's sort of and he's provided with a kind of mythological framework. They're not, you know, teaching him the Old Testament. There are Old Testament references through the story, but that's not what's going on. They're telling him these sort of urban legends of strange figures within German Jewish tradition. This Zinovich story about this Jew who, you know, sort of becomes in control and has this chutzpah, just sort of acting his way through things, and a couple of others. And my take on this is that, I mean, he finds some sort of grounding by his connection with these Jews, I think that Dublin probably underestimated the anti-Semitic component. In retrospect, maybe I'm seeing that through the lens of the Nazis, but I would say that there would have been a much more of an anti-Semitic component in the life of someone like Franz Bibikov. It seems to me Dublin is a little light-handed with that. And maybe that's because he's Jewish himself, I'm not sure. Right? But my guess is that a Franz Bibikov would have been pretty anti-Semitic. There would have been more, even if he was on the left, he would not have gone to the Jews for sort of solace in the middle of this disorientation. So I'm not sure exactly what to make up of that, and there may be the secondary literature deals with that, I'm not sure. But it would be an interesting topic to explore. It's kind of a puzzle for me. Okay, so let's move ahead to after he leaves the Jews. He goes back into the city. It was raining to the Lepfen Munstrasse. Signs sparkled in front of the movies. The corner he was unable to pass. The people were standing in front of a fence. Then it got very steep. The streetcar tracks ran on planks across the space. The car was just riding slowly over them. Look here, they're building a subway station. So there's all that construction going on. The streetcar tracks, subway, things are new. Another movie, right? So movies, cinemas are all over the place. Children under 17 not allowed. On the huge poster, a beet-red gentleman was standing on a staircase while a peach of a young girl embraced his legs. She lay on the stairs and he stood up above with a leering expression in his face. Underneath was written, "No parents, fate of an orphan child," in 6 reels. "Yes, sirree, I'll take a look at that." The orchestration was banging away. Price, 60 pfennigs, right? So popular culture, that sort of sexual promotion, conveying that sense of decadence, of decline, that the right will see it as that way, but of course attractive to someone like Franz. Right? He wants to go in and see that. On the next page, 29, the long room was packed full, 90% men with work caps on. They didn't take them off. So there are all these workers in there, but they're sitting in there watching the movie. Right? Well, there's a sign of the unemployment. There are all these unemployed guys just hanging out in the movie theaters by day. Right? And then the film starts, and you have all of this sort of racy popular entertainment being sold to the unemployed of Berlin. Okay, now on around 31, and the next page, he decides to hire a prostitute. 31, 32, 33, he hires the prostitute. "How much for a pleasure, kid? A black gal is fine, got hips." This is bottom of page 33. "When a gal's got a man she loves, ain't that grand?" Right? And in this sequence, he is impotent. He's unable to function. And then you get these scientific voices coming in. Remember, Dublin is a scientist, right? He is a doctor. So just above that, sexual potency depends on the concentrated action of the internal secretory system, the nervous system, the sexual apparatus, the glands participating, and so on and so forth. So you have this sort of impulse of the modern medical voice coming in the midst of this, which gives you an indication that he's not potent, and he's having difficulty with all of that. Right? 34, "I'm a cabaret singer, I am. You know where? Anywhere I like. Just now I got no engagement, you know. I go into nice-looking joints and I ask. Then I do my stunt. It's a wow. Hey, quit tickling. I hold an auction in the place. No plate collection either. Whoever gives me something can kiss me. Crazy, ain't it? In a public place, too. Nobody under 50 pfennigs. Say I get everything. Here on my shoulder. There, go ahead. It's all right." She puts on a man's top hat. There's Melina Dietrich. Croaks into his face and shakes her hips, her arms akimbo, and so on. So you have the voice of this, you know, decadent female type, right? The independent young woman, but she's on the street. She's having to do this in order to survive, but very much part of this liberated, open sexuality in the streets of Berlin at the time. Okay, let's go ahead to page 38. Okay. Here's a very famous section of this sense of disorder, the sense of things are falling apart, the sense of impending doom. "There are mountains that have been standing for centuries, that have always been standing, and armies with guns have gone over them. There are islands, people on them, chock full, all strong, solid business houses, banks, industry, dancing, dives, import, export, social questions. And one day there starts a rrrr, rrrr, not from the warship. The rumpus starts all by itself, from down below. The earth gives a jump. Nightingale, nightingale, how beautifully you sang. The ships fly to the skies. The birds fall to earth." Okay, so this is running through his head, the sense that, you know, there are solid things, there are mountains, there are businesses, there are nations, and so on, but then this rrrr starts and things start to fall apart. Oh, there are mountains that have been lying quiet for myriads of years, and armies with guns and elephants have gone over them. What is one to do when they suddenly start to caper? Because down below there's a noise that goes rrr, rrr. Don't let's say anything about that. Let's leave it alone. So in his mind, he just has these constant visions of things falling apart, or this sense of disorientation in the midst of all of this. Okay, now he's with Minna, which is previous girlfriend's sister, right? And he was in jail for having attacked Ida, and now he attacks Minna. So that violence, that brutalization of society, which I don't think it's a stretch to say, in general, is the impact of the First World War. Right, that brutalization of those soldiers out there, it translates into this brutal street fighting going on in Munich and in Berlin during this period between the political groups, but also just a tough, sort of vicious sexuality. At least this is a symbol for that. And the expressionists had long used rape or sex murder as an image for, you know, what was going wrong with Western society. They had been using that before the First World War. And in fact, you could trace it back to people like Baudelaire in the middle of the 19th century, who said, look, this is something that we have to understand. This is something we have to deal with. Well, de Bleijn is putting that right in the center. Sexual violence is really the story behind all of this. In some sense, it's what carries this whole story along. It's in the background with Franz, and it's central to Reinhold and his abuse of those girls, and ultimately the murder of Mise, right? So vicious treatment of women is emblematic of this sort of brutal, a symbol of that brutal environment of the post-war. Now, let's go to page 63. And I'm not sure if this is the first one, but as we've moved through this, there have been a number of these little asides that are slipped into Franz's story of descriptions of other situations going on in Berlin. And this is a kind of a cubist strategy, which was, in literature was designed to show, well, it's not just what's happening here, but other things are taking place simultaneously. You have to remember that. And these things have to be read as, although we read them in a linear way, as representing the fact that certain things are taking place in the city at the same time that Franz is doing this. And, you know, to get a global view, we need to take those things into account as well. And also then just those inserts of sort of a Berlin collage. You get a feel for all the things that are going on around the events of his life. Right? But you have this, you know, very strong symbol of the decadence of the period, with a sequence here in which a very young girl is coming with her music case under her arm, and then engaging in romantic interlude with a very elderly man with horn-rimmed glasses. Right? So she comes in to play the music, but eventually that turns into upstairs. They smile at each other. He stands in the corner. He's taken off his coat and hat. She lets him take her hat and music case. Then she runs to the door, switches off the light. But not long today. I have so little time. I must get home. I won't undress. Are you not going to hurt me? Right. So, you know, this very troubling, you know, representative image of a very young little girl involved sexually with an elderly man. Okay, let's skip ahead now to page 96. And here we have a situation where Franz runs into one of these myriad veterans out there. And just a little sequence there where we get a sense of their presence and the attitude and what they symbolize in this interwar period. They drank each other's health. Flourish of trumpets by the band. We have nothing to drink. We have nothing to drink. Hey there, cut that out. Cheer up, perk up. Three cheers for old, good old Gemütlichkeit. Are you a German? Are you a German to the bone? What's your name? Franz Biebekopf. Say, fatty, he don't know me. The veteran whispered. Are you a German? Honest and true? If you run with the Reds, you're a traitor. He is a traitor, isn't my friend. He embraced Franz. The Poles, the French, the fatherland for which we bled. That's the nation's gratitude. Okay. So here's this disaffected veteran connecting with Franz. He can sense, I guess, that Franz was a veteran, and he was. It comes in very subtly, but he sings the Wach am Rhein, and he sings Ich hatte eine Kamerade. So he's singing German military songs, and then he mentions a battle, Arras, at which he had been. That was before having been thrown in jail. Arm in arm, the cripple and Franz sit at the bar. So he's a war wounded, right? And complaining about the fact that the nation is not giving him any gratitude, is not giving them any gratitude for what they've done. Now, in 97, Franz picks up the job of selling racist pro-Nordic papers. He is not against the Jews, but he is for law and order that runs through all of this. And again, I think it would have been pretty easy to make Franz a racist, and maybe that's Döblin's point, is that people like Franz weren't, maybe it was possible for German culture to survive without having taken this anti-Semitic turn. He's just doing it because he needs a job. Right? He just needs to be able to sell the papers. He doesn't care that much about it. But he is in search of law and order, and that runs through a lot of this. And in some ways, that's the duality that's set up through the whole of the story, is that everything's disorderly, everything keeps collapsing in on him. He wants to do things well, he wants to do things honestly, he wants to lead a clean life, right? But external disorder, external forces, external violence keeps interrupting him. So what he wants most intensively is law and order, some sort of stability in which he can function. And then what he remembers most positively about the being in jail was his sense that it provided order, balance, and stability. He misses that. And you know, it's hard to say if that's what Döblin was trying to set up, but in advance of the whole rest of the book and the conclusion, someone like Franz probably would ultimately have ended up supporting the right, simply because they would have promised law and order. It's not to the left that they would turn for that after the events of the Weimar Republic, but to the right. And it wouldn't have had anything to do even with Hitler's charisma or Hitler's program or the anti-Semitic component, but the sense of structure that the National Socialist movement would offer. Okay, let's move to page 116. He's bubbling over. He's done time in Tegel. Life is awful. What kind of life is this? The fellow who wrote that song is right. I mustn't think about what happened to me, Ida. So lyrics of songs are popping into his head, interacting with his own thoughts. In the middle of the next paragraph. I didn't go to the front and lie in the trenches for this. So you could bait me, you agitators. We've got to have order, order. I'm telling you, order. Put that in your pipes and smoke it. Order and nothing else. Yes, that's it. Here we are. That's just it. And if anybody comes and starts a revolution now and don't give us order, they ought to be strung up all along the street. Okay, so there's that thrust, desire for order. Yes, then we'll have order. Then they'll be quiet. That's the only thing to do. We'll find that out. So even though Franz isn't associated with the Nazis or any political group, there is that desire for order, and if it takes violent action, he would be in support of it. the same time this roaring man hears his own voice, page 117, from far away is looking at himself. The houses threaten to cave in again, the roofs to smash over him. This won't do. No, they can't get away with that. Those criminals won't succeed. What we need is order. So he keeps feeling that things are smashing in on him. What he needs is some sort of stability and structure. In his twilight state, he is frightened. Something is out of gear with the world. The others seem so terrible to him. He experiences it with a sort of clairvoyance. Okay. Something's out of gear with the world. The others seem so terrible to him. That's what Gauche was communicating in that painting dedicated to Oscar Panizza. Right? Just the vision of Franz, of everything falling apart, of these vicious institutions seeking their own self and aggrandizement, all those others out there being vicious and competing with one another in a brutal way. Right? That painting is consistent with the kind of attitude that Franz is feeling here. Okay, now, I've sort of left the story off, but starting in the third book, his girlfriend Lena puts him into contact, this is around 31, with her uncle, Ludas, and Ludas is making money by selling shoestrings. That's all he's down to. He's able to make eke out a living by selling shoestrings, and they're desperate to find something for Franz to do. Selling the newspapers hasn't done really well. He's just got in trouble for carrying around these right-wing newspapers and clashing with communists and so on. So he starts to sell shoestrings as well. And then starting around page 137 or so, he is just going up through these apartments, going to the doors and trying to sell these shoestrings. And he knocks on the door of this woman who's a widow. And on page 137, he says that you're a widow. That's true, ain't it? Yes. What about your husband? Dead? Killed in the war? So you have all of these widows around. Right? Very accurate representation. And this is why you have so many women out there struggling for themselves and trying to make a living and ultimately prostituting themselves if they have to, because there are so many women left behind with really no options in that kind of an economy. Well, she's attracted to him and seduces him more or less, and in fact, on page 139 or so, he has affectionate feelings for her, romantic feelings for her. Right? But he lets Ludas know this, and Ludas ultimately goes back and gets into her apartment and attacks her. Right? So he's undone by that. Ludas has cheated him, scammed him, and then take advantage of this woman that he had a warm relationship developing. Right, so just another slam. Right? And after that, Franz is just going to drink himself into oblivion. He's going to break away. It's his first effort, or his first efforts at getting out there and succeeding and doing things in a clean way and finding jobs and so on, collapse after that. So just talking over books 3 and 4. let's go to pages 172. The Slaughterhouse in Berlin. And thus, this begins about a 10-page sequence in which you get all these details on the slaughterhouse. In the northeast part of the city, you get all the technical details of its size, of the investments, and then detailed descriptions of all the nitty-gritty that goes into the slaughter of these animals and the production of food for the big city. Page 179, supply at the cattle market. 1,399 steers, 1,200 calves, 4,654 sheep, 18,864 hogs, so on and so forth. And then on pages 180 and 181, the actual process of slaughtering. Of course, we have our little slaughterhouse news in the United States this week, but most people don't think about the violence and the brutality that goes into the production of that food. Right? So he's giving you that background scene. Of course, it all becomes a symbol for the viciousness and the brutality on the streets than in the background of Weimar society and the background of Weimar politics. Page 180. The butcher stands behind it with his hammer uplifted. Don't look around, speaking to the steer. The hammer lifted by the strong man with his both fists is behind you, above you, and then, zoom, down it comes. The muscular force of a strong man like an iron wedge is in its neck. And a second later, the hammer has not yet been lifted. The animal's four legs give a spring. The whole heavy body seems to fly up with a jerk. And then, as though it had no legs, the beast, the heavy body, falls down on the floor with a thud onto its rigidly cramped legs, lies like this for a moment, drops on his side. Right. Then you have all the processes of gutting him, applying the knife, the blood gushing, and so on. So he goes into this great detail, providing the background to, page 182, the well-lighted butcher shop. The lighting of the store and that of the show window should be made to harmonize. Predominantly direct or semi-indirect lighting should be used. In general, fixtures for predominantly direct lighting are practical because store, desk, and chopping block, above all, should be well lighted. Right? So you have this very clean, sanitized version of food production, you know, which most of us don't even know that those packages come from animals. You don't even think about it. It's been disconnected completely. And, of course, that becomes a metaphor for all that viciousness that's going on in the background, or you might even say the viciousness of the First World War that's the background to the whole of the Weimar Republic. Okay, let's go to page 213. I mean, a lot of these things are repetitive. The fear, the sense of disorder, things collapsing, the need for order, and so on. So I'm throwing out a few examples of those, but there's just that general sense. And you can find more and more examples of these things. Now, Franz is trying to revive. This whole sequence is taking place when he was, you know, out of it, blotto, just doing this drinking, and he's getting these sequences, that violent background of the slaughterhouse and so on and so forth. But he's going to try to get going again on page, 208. I'll go to 208. Let's get up. Page 208. Franz Bibikopf tidied himself in front of the mirror. He's going to try again. The man who wasn't at all edified when he saw his pale, sluggish, pimply cheeks was Bibikopf. What a mug that fellow has. Welts on his forehead. Wonder what the welts come from his cap, and that nose like a cucumber. Boy, gee, what a thick red smeller he's got. But that doesn't have to be on account of the booze. It's cold today. Only those ghastly old goggle eyes like a cow's. Wonder where I got those calves' eyes from, and that vacant stare as if I couldn't blink 'em. Well, there's the doppelganger, the dual personality, right? He's looking at himself in the mirror as if it's another person. He's just commenting on himself. Right? So you have that dualistic nature, which Fritz Lang picks up in a film like The M. Franz had muscles. He was once a member of an athletic club. Now he trotted through Alexanderstrasse and noticed the kind of steps he was taking, firm and solid, like a soldier of the Kaiser's Guard. So he had been a soldier. He is strong. He thinks he can get things going on his own. He has the power to do that. He's used to being successful physically, let's say in war, right? But also perhaps as an athlete before that. Here we go, right in step with the others. He's trying to get into order with the others, with the masses. This is that effort to recover after that breakdown. And then that sort of picks up on page 213. You do not know me, because you do not know who I am, who Franz Bibikopf is. He's not afraid of anything. I have my fists. Just look at what muscles I have. So there's that sense of that individual power, that individual prowess, that he is going to be able to somehow pull himself together and be successful, to take on fate, to take on these forces that seem to be at work against him. Okay, well, I got to stop to the fifth book, and we'll pick up some more of those. But, you know, it's just those—it's those tidbits, and the book is absolutely full of them. I'm just giving you some highlights and how they tie up with the modernist expression and representation of the Weimar era. There are some direct indications of politics, and maybe I'll try to underscore a few of those at the beginning next time. But basically, it's that kind of atmosphere, that sense of the brutalization, the sense of the individual being overwhelmed, the sense of pessimism, this sense of things falling apart and the desire for order, those are the kind of themes I want you to keep looking for.